Good morning. It's time for In the Green Outdoors with Gail Martin and Carol Kelly. Each week, the ladies will bring you gardening and planting ideas, tell you about native Ohio plants, prairies and habitats, and great tips for everything in the green outdoors. This week with Carol Kelly.
Hello again, everyone. Well, after this past week's stretch of downright balmy weather, I expect it's too late to urge you to hold off doing a thorough garden cleanup. Mid to late April really should be the earliest we consider clearing away leaves. Otherwise, we risk killing or damaging various species of native bees that have been sheltering in such garden debris over the winter. Keep in mind that some bees don't emerge until late May, so the longer you can tolerate your messy garden, the better. Ideally, waiting to clean up the garden until after pear and apple blossoms have faded will protect a majority of native bees from losing overwintering resources. If you have so far resisted the urge to play in the dirt, good for you. But to give you a bit of a fix, the lengthening days of March are a good time to repot your houseplants. When you're preparing to repot, water your plants with a dilute liquid seaweed solution several days beforehand. This will give the plant a bit of a boost and help prevent transplant shock, especially if you'll be trimming off a dense mass of roots. The only exception to this is if you have a plant that is so root-bound that the water just runs right through. In that case, just wait until you have trimmed and loosened the root ball. Clean your plants up by washing off the leaves and trimming out any dead bits. Use a good quality soilless mix when you repot. If you feel the plant requires a larger pot, only move up one pot size. Often you simply can prune the roots back a bit, gently loosen the soil from around them with your fingers, and settle them into a new pot with fresh soil. If you have access to vermicompost, as I do, mix a few tablespoons of that into your soilless mix when repotting. Once settled into the new pots, give them another light watering of seaweed emulsion. Now, I've been cleaning out old files and came upon my notes for several in-person presentations that I'd given locally some years back regarding the history of Victory Gardens. While I would not expect the last couple of generations to know anything about Victory Gardens, I must say that I was surprised to learn that some baby boomer acquaintances I was talking with recently only had the very vaguest idea of what a Victory Garden was. We're all concerned with food prices and possible shortages these days. Since the beginning of this year, I have devoted several of In the Green Outdoors programs to discussing novel ways to grow certain foods in our kitchen windowsills and countertops until we can get outdoors to plant. Home gardens are important again these days, too, as they promote the well-being of our families as well as the environment. So, in the hope that my listeners might be inspired by the enthusiasm of our grandparents and great-grandparents who rose to the challenge of providing healthy food for their families in the early 20th centuries, here's a very brief, condensed history of Victory Gardens as our topic for today. The planting of Victory Gardens began in World War I. As the war in Europe raged on, a crisis beyond the horrors of warfare itself emerged. Europe was running out of food. Barren from drought and often the scene of battles, fertile farmland across the European continent was rapidly disappearing. Combined with political issues like trade embargoes and labor shortages, and due to many farmers and farmhands having been drafted into the war, there were fewer people left to plant and tend to crops. No European country had the ability to grow a sustainable food supply for the foreseeable future, but the United States had plenty of safe, open farmland. In 1917, fears that the U.S. entry into the war in Europe would lead to food shortages caused food prices to skyrocket. With transportation resources being directed towards the war effort, fresh produce became scarce nationwide. In New York City, riots broke out when the price of cabbage went up 2,000%. Shortly before America entered the war in early 1917, Charles Lathrop Pack, a third-generation timberman and one of the five wealthiest men in America at that time, organized the National War Garden Commission. In addition to alleviating Europe's food shortage, Its goal also was to, quote, arouse the patriots of America to the importance of putting all idle land to work, to teach them how to do it, and to educate them to conserve by canning and drying all food that they could not use while fresh. Herbert Hoover, appointed by President Woodrow Wilson to head the U.S. Food Administration, was given the power to distribute, export, import, purchase, and store food. The Food Administration encouraged Americans to grow their own food in war gardens, since our government wanted to guarantee that ample food existed for our men serving the armed forces, as well as for America's allies overseas. By growing war gardens, the American people could provide for themselves instead of needing to purchase food grown by farmers, which then could be sent overseas to feed troops and allies. The U.S. government developed and distributed a pamphlet called War Gardening and Home Storage of Vegetables, resulting in the War Gardens of America producing food that helped establish the balance of power between starvation and abundance in Europe during the final 2 years of the war. The pamphlets taught novice gardeners about soil, compost, crops, how to assemble cold frames, and more. With nationwide rationing of meat, sugar, fat, and flour, these widely distributed pamphlets instructed gardeners on how to prevent food waste, promoted food storage, seed saving, canning, and preserving. The federal agency hired talented artists and graphic designers to produce posters, brochures, cartoons, and billboards. Those, along with newspapers and magazines, spread the word, publicizing the need for planting gardens as a patriotic duty. As a result, gardens were planted at private residences, alongside factories, and on public land both then and again during World War II, in order to reduce the pressure on the public food supply brought on by the war effort. Roughly 3 million gardens were sown by December of 1917, and that number soared to 5.25 million within the next year. This not only provided more food on the home front, but meant that the U.S. was able to send 20 million tons of food overseas by July 1919. Also early in the First War, Britain had created the Women's Land Army. Once America joined the Allies, some women's universities in the United States took a cue from Britain and began training women to work the land in order to support the agricultural needs of the United States. In the summer of 1917, Barnard College formed the Women's Agricultural Camp in Bedford, New York, which was attended by 142 women for 4 months. The camp provided lectures, training, and hands-on experience on local farms. Women who enrolled in the programs at any of several other universities involved had to pay a fee for their training. This meant that upper and middle-class women made up the majority of those enrolled in courses, since working-class women could ill afford to pay the fees. However, some of these women helped during harvest periods. Women aged 18 and over were eligible to join the Women's Land Army of America as long as they passed a physical exam to prove that they were fit enough to tackle the demands of agricultural work. This organization instituted an 8-hour day and, listen to this, required farmers to pay women the same wages as male laborers. Although supported by President Wilson, there was no federal funding for the WLAA. Private contributions, many from women's organizations, provided for the administration of the program. At first, farmers and the media did not look favorably upon employing women in fieldwork, believing that these young urban women would not be able to cope with the difficult working conditions on a farm. However, the women of the WLAA proved capable and successful. All in all, historians estimate that between 15,000 and 20,000 women took part in the Land Army across America. The organization was formally disbanded in early 1920 due to financial difficulties. Also, post-war gardens then quickly declined in number. City parks once again became places to play instead of places to grow fruits and vegetables. Then came the excesses of the Roaring Twenties, followed by the Great Depression. Ordinary families went hungry due to unemployment. City governments, realizing the seriousness of the situation, put relief gardening programs in place to combat hunger, poverty, and emotional stress. Interest in gardening had waned after Armistice Day in 1919, but increased again through those Depression years. In the early years of the Depression, ordinary citizens once more rose to the challenge by organizing and supporting garden relief programs. The country's experience with the success of gardens in World War I, and then again in the early 1930s, made them open to the idea of victory gardens once World War II approached. Prior to the bombing of Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, national gardening efforts had been called the National Defense Gardening Program. Following the economic hardships of the Great Depression, by 1942, the country instituted the food rationing program, but within 3 weeks after Pearl Harbor, the government once again fell back on the name Victory Gardens. By 1943, with emphasis on gardening as key to winning the war, the program was widely publicized and supported. Citizens once more were encouraged to supplement their families' meals with produce from their own gardens, while farmers grew the essentials. Thousands of government-sponsored advertisements convinced the public that food was a weapon of strategic importance. As one ad explained, if folks on the home front used food wisely, it would fight for freedom. Victory Gardens became a way of supplementing families' diets during a time when many foods were scarce because of rationing, a formal restriction that had not occurred during the First War, when instead patriotic self-sacrifice was simply expected. Throughout America, people once more plowed front yards, backyards, lawns, vacant lots, even city rooftops were growing vegetables. Local communities often banded together to plant gardens, such as the one in Summit County, organized by the Clinton Parent Teacher Organization, and in Columbus by the Columbus Garden Club. Neighbors were encouraged to share tools, since metal was in short supply. So people pooled their resources and formed cooperatives. They shared seeds and planted a variety of foods. Just as in the First World War, this local produce vastly reduced the manpower needed to transport commercially grown produce from farm to market, and thus released men for other forms of work or as soldiers on the front lines. It also freed up thousands of trucks and trains from having to move civilian supplies and made those available for transporting troops and war materiel. On January 23, 1943, the Columbus radio show Joe Doak's Civilian featured Victory Gardens. Host Irwin Johnson interviewed OSU Extension agent Joseph H. Boyd, who was the director of the Victory Garden Council. Boyd told people where they could get seeds and fertilizer, and he also wrote pamphlets for the Agricultural Extension Service with detailed instructions for what, when, and how to plant vegetables that were easiest and would do well in Ohio, which vegetables most likely would be damaged by insects, and which were most nutritious. While Americans were familiar with canned corn, beans, and peas, families had to learn about and become accustomed to vegetables like Swiss chard and kohlrabi, introduced due to shortages of other seeds. Weeds such as lamb's quarters were foraged and even canned in place of spinach. In 1943, at least 40% of vegetables consumed by Americans were homegrown. In Ohio alone, more than 1 million gardens were under cultivation in that year. Victory Gardens were widely promoted during 1943 through 1945. However, once the war ended, so did government promotions and America's reliance on Victory Gardens. Overall, the U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that more than 20 million gardens were planted. Fruit and vegetable harvest from home and community plots was estimated to be from 9 to 10 million tons, an amount equal to all commercial production of fresh vegetables. Yes, the program made a huge difference. I'm sure some of our listeners have family memories of Victory Gardens. My grandfather's workplace, the American Blower Company in Detroit, was one company that gave over land for gardens, and Gramp continued to plant a garden well after the war. Surely his example, along with my own memories and appreciation of that fresh garden produce, were what moved me to begin gardening over 40 years ago. And since then, I've grown food in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Ohio, and even for 7 years while we lived and worked in Brussels, Belgium. Over the winter, I sorted through my assortment of flower and vegetable seeds and tossed out onto the snow for the birds, the oldest ones that I could not depend upon to germinate readily. Right after the winter holidays, I obtained the seeds I want to plant this year via mail order and planned my garden on paper. In my next segment in 2 weeks, I'll talk about how and why I pre-sprout various seeds prior to planting them out in open ground. I'll also present some information about planting potatoes, peas, and other hardy early crops. Until then, this is Carol Kelly saying, let's take inspiration from our ancestors and each do our part to supply our families with healthy food that we can grow ourselves here in the green outdoors.
And there's your show for the week. In the Green Outdoors is a production of WZMO Radio. The show airs Saturdays and Mondays right after the second cup at about 9:30 a.m. If you have a question or comment for Carol or Gail, you can email it to WZMO@roadrunner.com. Thank you for listening.